All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 157. It is Thursday, October 13th, 2022. I'm here with Deborah and Chud. What's going on, guys?
Another beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Chud?
Yeah, I'm sick of talking about it, so I'll make it brief to say it's not such a beautiful day here as it's over 80 degrees and smoky as all can be. Like smoke. It looks blue, light blue when I look up, but any distance, it's just this brown, just worn out, disgusting air.
And I'm how close is it to where you are?
Where's burning?
You know, it's hard to say. When I try to look at maps, it shows it to be pretty far away.
Is it in Canada?
I think there's some in Canada that aren't showing up on my map. But then the nearest one is down by like Everett, like east of Everett, which is practically Seattle.
Yeah.
So like hundreds of miles from here.
It's weird. It's not smoky here at all.
Yeah.
And it's hot as balls. It's 85.
Lanny looked up Seattle weather report yesterday. I think it was yesterday, maybe 2 days ago. And theirs actually said smoke. Like smoke warning in Seattle.
Yeah.
But we haven't had any kind of warning. They're not telling us the air quality's bad or anything like that. It's just nasty out there though.
Yeah. Yeah. According to the weatherman in my hand computer, it says the air quality is moderate. It says it's 70 degrees outside. I don't buy it. Mm-hmm. I went outside.
My phone says you're 80 degrees.
Yeah. So stupid. I went outside on the back porch, the south side of the house, and my little thermometer out there says 115 degrees in the sunlight. So I was out.
Average it somewhere.
Yeah, I was out splitting firewood until like noon, and I was like, I gotta come in. It's too hot out. So
I couldn't do an activity like that here right now.
Yeah,
and the heat.
Yeah, it's one of those stupid days where you like get angry at something that you have no control over, you know. It's like much like how we get in late spring when it won't stop raining or something like that, you know.
Same feeling.
Tacoma has an air quality alert also.
Yeah, that's probably just from the homeless encampments like emanating or stink into the air. That's probably a constant. As much as I like
the Tacoma aroma.
I was going to say, that's the classic Frank Zappa line.
Tacoma aroma.
I like Tacoma, but I also, you know, lived in East Oakland for a long time. So I like these dumpy blue collar towns. Yeah. Tacoma actually is still a real industrial blue collar town. So
yeah. Yeah. Whenever I do find myself there, which is rare, I'm always like, wow, it's amazing. It's like, there's tons of businesses everywhere, and they're all like auto body shops and like functional businesses. It's not
radiator repair, like welding shops. Like
it's like most other cities of that size that I go into. It's like restaurants and bars and, you know, stuff like that. Here it's people working and businesses to help those people live their lives, you know.
Yeah.
Seems a lot of construction, a lot of apartment buildings being thrown up.
Yeah, it's kind of getting the that Oakland treatment, you know, like in the early 2000s, everybody started moving over to that side of the bay and commuting into the city because it was cheaper. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what's going on there right now because it's proximity to Seattle.
Seattle,
right. Right.
I remember when I was considering leaving California, I called up the Seattle Union Hall and asked them like what their mechanics rate was and stuff like that. Cause we were up visiting Deborah's other daughter for Thanksgiving. And I was like, oh, I could live here. You know, you can still afford a house here, but you have to commute to Seattle every day. I guess the traffic's real bad. I didn't want to deal with it. So,
but
other than that, what else is going on? Oh, let's do business, guys. Value for value. You know the spiel. Time, talent, treasure. I think we're due for a new theme song. Intro and outro, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do a some sort of 80s type synth wave new intro song, you know,
Synth wave, what does that mean?
Just like some electronic synth music.
Synth pop.
Yeah.
I thought you said scent, like
yeah, open your ears, get some Q-tips.
Synthwave.
You ever listen to Jay Dyer's podcast?
Occasionally.
He does, every once in a while, he'll just like have these songs that he makes, and they're so funny. He like recently did one. He put it up on Twitter, like, and like paired it with a bunch of like Alex Jones commentary, like Alex Jones. He made it look like Alex Jones is commenting on his little music video. Like Alex Jones is going like, who is this maggot? And then like it flashes to Jay Dyer like dancing, and like he's singing this like 80s pop song about getting married to a Funko Pop, and it's really funny. I put it on, it's on my Twitter, I reposted it. So
that sounds great.
That guy's got a lot going on. He's a font of knowledge, and you know, he's got that, I told you about that TV series, Jay Dyer.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the one on Gaia.
On Gaia, and he makes music, and he sings songs, and he makes jokes. So
yeah, he is a really, really. I know John Brisson would disagree with this statement, but a really intelligent theologist. Like, he knows so much about. Well, he's Orthodox Christian. He knows so much about it. He does debates with people all the time and stuff like that. So yeah. Like I said, we had him scheduled once on the show and he didn't come. So I had a little bit of a grudge against him for a while, but I'm over it by now. And maybe I'll reach out to him again and ask him to come on, tell him I'm on the path, and he'll come on because of that or something like that. Yeah. So yeah. But I thought you were talking about Alex Jones, man.
Oh,
yeah. I saw this morning that he owes about $1 billion.
$1 billion.
When you hear that judgment come down, Deborah, I mean, what do you think?
It's
about that?
Unreal. That's just, I mean, who that?
What do you think that they're? I mean, doesn't it kind of seem to me? It seems like they do that, and that's sending a message to everyone who is willing to get into some murky waters like we do a lot of the time. You better not. We will take all the money you have. I bet you Alex Jones, I mean, I don't know what he's got. He claims he has a couple million bucks in the bank, you know?
Yeah. And who has $975 million?
Is that a way that they could just bankrupt him and then take every cent that he ever makes for the rest of his life?
Yeah, that's what that looks like to me. B, like you said, it sends a message to people who are trying to do things like him. But another thing that occurred to me is something that I'm sure you've heard this before, Adam, and I've heard it from people, that it's that there's this idea amongst normies out there that people only do things like conspiracy podcasts because they make so much money.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, right. And this is going to reinforce that thought for a lot of people. They're going to go, they're not going to look at it. They're not going to question it in the way that we have just now. They're just going to go, yeah, see that Alex Jones guy, he's worth over $1 billion. Like, you know, that's what the motivation people have to go out and say that they're questioning these things, which is, it's so false.
we
can speak for that. Yeah. And we know plenty of other people who can too.
Yeah. It's, at this level, there's not much money in it. You know, we've got some really fantastic loyal supporters, and we're very thankful for them, but you know,
we're not in it for the money.
Most folks in the conspiracy world are lucky if they break even. And I think even more so, most of them pay out to do what they do.
Yeah.
They don't make it back, and they certainly don't come home with a profit.
Yeah. This podcast is paid for a couple bags of chicken feed for me. You know, that's about it.
Yeah. Right. So,
but, and at the same time, did you guys see the thing with PayPal?
No.
PayPal has said, I'm not sure the exact verbiage, but it comes down to, if you have said something offensive that we deem offensive, we're going to take $2,500 out of your PayPal account that you have linked with us, that we have linked to your bank.
How can they can't do that?
Hmm.
How can they do that? They're not the court. They're not the law. They're not the arbitrator of good taste.
Yeah, well, it's a private company.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe they might have updated their terms of service.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, we saw.
Did everybody click update terms of service and read it? And yeah, there it was, right in the middle of it, that they can take money from you and you can't say this or that. And if they so deem, they can sew your lips to the asshole of another person, keep you in that position for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, Deborah, that when you hear about things like that, that's a little taste of all this central bank digital currency stuff that we're always preaching about, you know?
Right.
And, you know, you're,
when but your that's money... like, you know, it's in the works, but it's, they're not saying this is what we're going to do now.
Right. But yeah. And it's just, I mean, I should start talking to people. It's like, is this where do I go erase my PayPal right now? Like, do I go get rid of it?
Yeah. I don't have one.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. And we already saw in Canada, Deborah, when all those trucker rallies were going on,
yeah,
they shut down their bank accounts. I mean, the government did it, but they shut down their bank accounts with, you know, the bank participated in that just for people protesting, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy. So have you guys been watching these videos of people in power, journalists, celebrities, talking heads of companies who have said things in the past year and a half that did not age well?
Not specifically.
No.
I can think of a lot of these things.
Yeah, they're all over Twitter. Just people, like, you know, with the hashtag never forget that they did this and things like that. We've just seen this video of the Pfizer director in some sort of European court, and she is saying, so our good friend Jason Basler, who was on the show like a month or two ago, said Pfizer's director, after 2.5 years of intense psychological warfare and institutionalized persecution of anyone rejecting the science, Pfizer director admitted the vaccine wasn't tested for transmissibility before rollout.
Wasn't tested for transmittability?
Transmissibility.
Transmissibility.
So saying that if you got vaccinated, that you couldn't give it to somebody else. I think of what that's saying.
Seems like
well, that's kind of like
what I heard a lot of people saying that.
Yeah. And that's all they said is like, if we heard them say it forever and ever and ever, if you get this, it stops. It stops with you.
Right.
You know, and that's what we heard. And then we heard 98% effective. It stops with you. Then we heard 87%. Then we heard 62.5%. Then we heard 30%. Then we heard it doesn't do anything, but you should go and you should get the booster.
And then I don't know if this is local or even real, because I haven't looked at it myself, but we had someone out from my day job. They tested positive. So they were gone for 7 days. They couldn't come back for 7 days. I don't know who's telling them this, but they couldn't be back for 7 days. Then on 7 days, they went and tested again and they tested positive. That was yesterday. And they didn't come in again today, although it seems to be a fact amongst people that after 7 days, if you test positive again, you're past the point of transmissibility. And they are welcome to come back. They're just not feeling that good. So they're going to stay home for a few more days. But I'm like, wait, when did that change? Was that the case a week ago? You know, like, I don't know.
That's been the case for a while.
Yeah. So you can test positive.
I heard it was like 5 days. I heard that if you test positive, you don't have to stay home. I heard all sorts of,
You don't have to quarantine.
It's just after. You just kind of make it up when you
exactly.
Just make it fit whatever you want. That could be a local Bellingham rule. You know,
yeah,
like
exactly.
Exactly.
It's,
yeah.
It just goes to show you. Mm-hmm. And then, there's been a whole bunch, not anybody that I follow on Twitter, but I see a whole bunch of people like reposting a bunch of blue check marks, issuing apologies and all sorts of stuff like that. And it's like, okay, cool. You're apologizing on Twitter saying,
I'm surprised that they're apologizing.
I was following the science. I'm sorry, you know, and, what those people don't see is that there's dead people because of what you said. Because so many people said that, there are people that are dead now. People that blew their brains out because they didn't have a job. There's people who didn't get vaccinated that the courts in Florida, of all places, took their kids away because they refused to get vaccinated.
That happened in Florida, huh?
Yeah, Dean... a while back, Dean played some footage of a judge taking custody, partial, like the dad, you know, it was a divorced family and the dad didn't want to get vaccinated. Of course, the dad, you know, if the mom did it, she would have gotten the kids probably. But saying I'm not, you know, refusing to do it and saying probably that they wouldn't do it for the kids and revoking custody of children because of their decision for nothing. And now we have proof that, I mean, we've had proof for a long, long time, just nobody wanted to listen to it from that side. People blew their brains out. I mean, I know so many people that I lost count. I mean, I can count that high, but that I don't even think of anymore. People that I know that overdosed and died, that people that I knew from 12-step stuff. That overdosed and died in the past 2 years because they did drugs. And, you know, before that, they weren't able to go to the 12-step stuff that was the community that helps people like me, you know?
Uh-huh. Because they weren't vaccinated. So they weren't welcome in the meetings. Is that what you're saying?
No, because they didn't have meetings, Deborah.
Right.
Meetings were canceled altogether.
Yeah.
You don't remember that part? You already forgot about that part where we couldn't
leave our houses? No, you know, my family member does Zoom.
Yeah.
So I know that's not the same. I know it's not the same.
That's like people having to do Zoom church as well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's really comparable to AA meetings as far as like suicide rates and things like that go. Or whatnot, but if you're struggling, we'll just say struggling spiritually, and they say, and you really need to talk to your pastor. And it's like, okay, yeah, you can do that, but you got to do that on Zoom. You can't have physical touch contact. You know, we'll talk you through what you're going through, but it's going to be over a screen. And if you don't have that screen, you're fucked.
Yeah, not everybody does.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know a guy, he drove to the Arco station on San Pablo. He rode his motorcycle to Arco station on San Pablo and 34th in West Oakland and shot himself in the head, you know, like.
It's rough.
Yeah. So, you know, stuff that you do, the actions that you have, it's not just on the surface. It all goes down the line, just like conspiracies. You just got to keep following it down the line and you get to some place that you didn't really realize that you were going to get. The more you do that, the more you start understanding this whole thing and that every action has an opposite and equal reaction and all sorts of unintended causes. Some might even say they were intended, you know, who knows. So I'll leave it at that, you know, but when we're talking about putting experimental bullshit that hasn't been tested, that you don't even know what's going to do to your body. And you just just because a doctor has told you to do it and you do no research, know nothing on your own. You don't even know what the medicine does and you just sign up for it.
and sign up for it and have it presented to you in a way that makes you think that you don't have a choice.
Yeah. Or just even if you do have a choice in doing it, you know,
like we talked about on the last one, you always have a choice, but a lot of people didn't see it that way because, you know, culture in general, but you know, then the in quotes powers that be telling you, you have to do it. The powers that be may just be your boss.
Yeah.
A lot of people took the experimental jab.
Yeah. A lot of people do a lot of experimental stuff and it's not always the best and it's not always proven to work. And it's not always, you don't know what's going to happen a couple of years down the road. So, Western medicine isn't the end all be all. Do your own research, guys. You know, there's all sorts of stuff out there that you can do besides stuffing a bunch of chemicals and poison into your body. So with that, let's pause. Let's let our guest in and we will be right back. All right, guys, we're back and we are here with our guest, who is MR Gorga. And MR, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we have been reading your book, Demons Among Us, correct?
Demons Among Us, Shocking Real Life Stories from the Paranormal. That is correct.
Yeah, Deborah's holding it up right there.
Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
She got the actual physical book. I've been reading it on Kindle. And it's wild stuff, man. And we're happy to have you here, especially in the month of October. We haven't done very much. We're like almost 160 episodes into our show, and we have done one paranormal episode before you a couple of weeks ago. So we have not done much, but we have been doing a lot of deep dives into spirituality, Christianity, demonic possession, all sorts of stuff like that. So,
right.
Yeah. We're excited to hear what you have to tell us. You want to get into a little history for us?
Sure. Would you want to know a little bit about me or?
Yeah, we'd love
to. Okay. Well, I'm a lifelong writer. I've been writing since I was a little kid. The paranormal is just something that really kind of connected with me really young, starting with, I kind of grew up in a time of Amityville horror, and some Son of Sam was running around New York, you know, killing people with a .44 caliber. And it's just this fear that kind of came over the tri-counties, and it was just sort of, for some reason, all that kind of stuff kind of made its way into my, into my writings and into my interests. I'm also a former journalist and advertising copywriter, and Demons Among Us is my first foray into this paranormal space, and it became a number one bestseller on Amazon, and now I'm here speaking with you.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the book so far, and you get into some demonic possession stuff that occurred in the colonies pre Salem witch trials. How did you come across the case of Elizabeth, what was her last name?
Knapp.
How did you come across her case, and why did you choose to highlight that one?
I was doing some reading, just some research. I mean, I knew from the get-go I was going to write a book called Demons Among Us. And as I was kind of just researching various things, I was researching a witchcraft book. And it kind of mentioned this story, but it was very, very high level and glossed over. And it was sort of like, well, this happened and this happened and dot, dot, dot. And I said, the journalist in me says, well, what's between those dot, dot, dots? And so, when I start kind of like peeling away the onion, and the more I peeled, the more fascinating this story became. It just kind of blossomed from there. I love history. I love research. And it just kept taking me deeper and deeper. And before you know it, I'm reading, 350-year-old yellow parchments with flat black flowing script from the 1600s, physically touching them. So when we talk about in-depth research for this story, I really went as deep and as far as you can go. And, the story itself was absolutely fascinating. And it was a little known story. And I just thought it deserved to be told in the right light. And in order to do that, I really had to have an understanding of the period, the culture, its customs, its social mindset, and everything that that surrounds this story between a 16-year-old maid and the town minister at the time in 1671. And as a Halloween tie-in, he started writing all of these strange, what he called atrocities to this girl on October 30th, 1671.
Who started writing them to her?
What happened was in the research, I found that in this story on Elizabeth Knapp, there is a journal. And so it was the minister's maid, and the minister started to see some really strange signs within this girl, 16-year-old girl. And it's so strange that he took to his journal and he started writing a blow by blow.
Got it. Of what happened. And that started.
Yeah. And that's
on Halloween Eve, 1671. And that started,
that's right. That's right. And it's the first fully documented eyewitness case of demonic possession in American history, because he wrote the blow by blow in his journal.
Got it.
Did you have the actual original manuscripts that he wrote, or the journal that he wrote?
I have. Yes, I have touched it. Yes, I've seen it physical.
Wow.
I don't want to say, because I don't want other people to go and.
Okay.
Was it like at a university or something to that effect? Maybe a museum.
Yeah, it was. It was at a. It was at a library.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow. 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 I have a question, and maybe I'm jumping in too soon, but why did the minister allow her to stay in his home for all that time if he had his suspicions? And he obviously did.
He obviously did. Yeah. I think he allowed it because, he knew her. She was part of his congregation. His father was James Knapp, and he actually helped build that meeting house of the town. It was called Groton. So he helped, he knew the family and he knew Elizabeth. And I honestly believe he just wanted to help. And part of it was the mystery of okay, what's really going on here? And so it just took him some time to really come to the conclusion that there was some really demonic stuff at work. I mean, he really tried to rule out medically and, had her checked out by a doctor as well, who treated her as well. But then these things, they just kept continuing and increasing in intensity and got more bizarre. And, at the end of the day, he had to finally come to the conclusion like, okay, this is something very demonic that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, it's interesting that you referred to what her father built as the meeting house, because Deborah and I are listening or getting into a book called Occult Feminism, and it goes into the dark occult roots of feminism in America.
Yeah.
And at one point, the author talks about how all these different forms of Christianity started to sprout up, and I forget which one it is that calls it a meeting house instead of a church.
Yeah.
And I just listened to that passage today, and it was not the Puritans, not pilgrims, but an early branch.
And it was a very, very plain type church.
No
crucifixes.
Yeah, no, nothing of the sort, because when they came over, you have to understand with who these people were. Their fathers were escaping the persecution of in England and in Britain, because they were persecuting believers or followers of Jesus Christ, or what would be termed Puritans or Pentecostals. And so these people, they were getting, escaping a bloody persecution. So when they came over here, they were coming over here to establish a land for the glory of God that the world had never seen. And so so they came over actually as a righteous thing. They looked at this as like the new world or the promised land. And so when they came over, they were trying to escape the trappings of Catholicism with all its pomp and its ornateness and everything. And so when they built their churches or their meeting houses, they left them very, very, very bare because they didn't want any of the trappings that they were trying to get away from. And so, and that's why you see like these very plain meeting houses, because the focal point is God and it's Jesus Christ and not, you know, the pomp and regalia of what we see in the Catholic churches.
Got it. Yeah. And they were also, it would have been the Church of England as well that they were trying
to escape. Yeah. Escaping the Church of England, who, what had happened was they had very close ties to Rome, and the Puritans, thing with them was that they didn't separate enough from the Roman Catholic roots. So they established the Church of England, but the Church of England still looked like the Roman Catholic Church. Right. So they didn't depart enough from what they called popish trash and popish idolatry.
Wow. Hmm. that's popish interesting.
Popish trash.
Popish trash.
That's a new one to call Catholics.
Well, that was sounds like a punk rock band.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm just reciting history.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, she gets some of the things that start happening to her. She starts, she becomes very disheveled. She starts having laughing fits. She's unable to concentrate. What is she doing? She's vomiting.
Barking.
Barking like a dog.
Yes.
And then she ultimately starts having these really bad seizures, correct?
Yes, correct. Well, not only was she, you know, going back to the barking of the dog, it wasn't that she was just barking like a dog. She was barking like a dog for 5 days straight and didn't go to sleep. And yeah. So, you know, so it was like this impossible, inhumanly thing, you know, an unhuman thing to actually do. And, you know, and there's episodes where they were trying to, you know, she would explode and start storming through the house, like in this howling rage. And there were true, you know, there was two episodes of where they were taken down. She was trying to get taken. They were trying to take her down with three or four people, but she just kind of like threw them off like nothing. So she had this like superhuman strength that she possessed in a couple of the episodes. And, you know, she would often try to, you know, throw herself into the fires. As a child, she tried to drown herself in a well, but her father caught her. But what it was she was being tantalized by the devil. And what she saw in the waters, it were things to tempt her. And she was trying to retrieve these things that she saw, you know, glistening in the water. So she tried to go in there, but you know, he was trying to get her to kill herself in that well. And so the story goes, it's ultimately between her and the minister, but it's also between her and Satan, and what, you know, what kind of relationship she had with the demonic, you know, this really dark side.
Yeah. I think the spookiest part that kind of gave me, shivers when I read it was when she was confessing to Samuel, the preacher, who was like the patriarch of the house that she was the maid at also,
right.
That she had walked up the stairs with a knife behind her back.
Yes.
To murder him.
Yeah.
And they had met and passed each other on the staircase, and she didn't do it, but
yeah. Well, what happened? Yeah. Cause so as she was going up the stairs, she was going up the stairs, what was a bill hook, which was a blade, but it was a kind of like a curved blade for cutting like shrubs and everything.
Yeah.
And so she was, you know, basically the devil tempted her to go kill him in his sleep. And so as she was going up the stairs, somehow he was awakened and he appears at the top of the stairs and she suddenly hides it behind her back. And, you know, he's like, well, what's going on? He had no recollection that she was about to kill him, but, you know, cause that wouldn't have entered into his thinking, like this teenage girl's coming to kill me in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
He was basically like, you know, what's going on? But he did see that she hid something behind her back. And then she later confessed that, she was going to go kill him.
Yeah, that's it was hard to hear. He had children and a wife in the
Yeah.
house too, you
And
know. So that's
his wife wanted to get her out of there.
nothing
The
to do
wife
with her.
said, nuh-uh.
Nothing to do with her. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I guess it just shows the heart of Samuel. His name was Samuel Willard. It just shows his heart that, you know, he was really trying to kind of get to the bottom of this thing with this young girl, you know. And the early colonies, they would have just completely tagged her with witchcraft. So he couldn't tell anybody what was going, really what was going on, because if he would have said anything to anybody, they would have told, you know, magistrates would have come in, authorities would have come in, they would have tagged her a witch, and they would have immediately, you know, and they would have, you know, they would have killed her. And at the very least, she would have been scarred for life or branded for life with as a witch, which would have, you know, it in the in that time and in those colonies, you know, it was better to be called a murderer than a witch.
Yeah, and it was really a like a testament to his faith that
Yes.
he felt that he could actually help her even with a wife and children in the house
Yeah.
and to protect her against you know the community at large
Yeah.
and yeah it's
Well, it's an amazing story. You know, I'm just so glad that I, you know, was able to kind of put it into the book, because it was so little known, and no one really knows about the story. And so I was, you know, it was important for me to kind of bring it to light, because it's so unnerving, and it's so you know, so much, so creepy.
Yeah.
That, you know, deserved to be told. Yeah.
How many years later was the actual Salem witch trials?
2 decades, 20 years.
20 years later, and then leading up to the witch trials, was there a rash of like witchcraft accusations and things like that throughout the Massachusetts colony?
I'm sure there were like some, you know, skirmishes of witchcraft, but I think, you know, once we get to Salem, you know, that's kind of like when we have this explosive kind of thing. And by the way, Samuel Willard was involved with this, the witch trials. In fact, he tried to stop them. It was because of his case, of this case of experience with Elizabeth Knapp, which qualified him to actually be a part of the witch trials. And you know, so he argued in court because they wanted to allow spectral evidence. Now,
Yeah, I remember that
right.
that quote at the end of the chapter put really stood out to me is about the specter as evidence. I kind of wanted to ask you about that.
Right, yeah. So spectral evidence would have been like, you know, somebody's spirit attacking a person. So you know, not, you know, physically being there, but basically astral planing out of their body and coming into their home, and then, you know, and then, you know, using various things, pins and needles, and you know, hitting or biting or whatever, just attacking somebody in this spectral form. Well, Samuel Willard was like, well, this can't hold up in court, because if this is the case, like, they're gonna see, you know, a witch under every, you know, under every barrel cart, and you know, and behind every tree is gonna be a witch. So you know, this is not sufficient enough to charge a witch, charge for a witchcraft crime, which was a capital crime. By the way, it was like, that was a witchcraft charge, was a death sentence. And so the spectral evidence he was arguing against was not sufficient enough to convict on a witchcraft charge. Excuse me, I'm tongue-tied.
Yeah, so they didn't heed his advice, and they allowed all that.
It doesn't appear that the advice was heeded. And because, and the reason why was because the colonies itself, the colony themselves, were really washed up in this, you know, this tide of this inebriating tide of whatever it was. It was just kind of like this tide of fear and
Hysteria.
hysteria, exactly the word I was looking for. Yeah. And it was much like, you know, we all like to think that we couldn't get awash in this kind of hysteria, but I
we
think
we
we've
we
seen
just we
that,
just did for the last
but we
13
just
years.
all did. We
Yeah.
just all did. I mean, not me, but we
Yeah.
just all did.
Yeah.
But
So the
ergot? Is that how you say it?
I knew you were going to
ergo poisoning.
Yeah, is that how much does that play into what happened in Salem? Supposedly, everybody was eating moldy bread.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they said the same thing about when God sent judgments on Egypt and all the firstborn died, right? They said the same exact thing. And then what I say about the firstborn is like, okay, why only the firstborn, right? That doesn't make sense in Egypt. And going over to Salem witch trial, why only these few people? It doesn't make sense. And not the whole, and why not the whole of Salem? And it wasn't just, there were two Salems. There was Salem town and there was Salem village. And why not all the Salems, you know?
Uh-huh.
So why would it just be those few people
when everybody's and not eating the, rest, the same
bread? Yeah. Right.
Uh-huh.
Do you think the devil was in Salem?
Yeah, I think that there was it started at Samuel Parris's, and he was the minister at the time, right? He was kind of like, I guess he was like a kind of rather new minister at the time in that, you know, in Salem. And something happened to his kids, and the kids were like going into seizures and coughing up pins and, you know, just some real crazy, you know, crazy stuff. And so I think that there was something that sparked it, but I do not believe that everyone was a witch. I believe there was something that happened that was demonic. But what happened was there was a lot of, there were a lot of jealousies and there were a lot of, finger pointing and anger towards other neighbors and properties lining with other properties that they had, they wanted that land. And so it was like, there was a bit of pettiness to the colony as well. And you know, when you start reading these transcripts, you're like, wow, this is real petty stuff. But there was a lot of special interest, I think, behind some of these accusations.
Have you ever seen that that movie that came out a few years back called The Witch?
Yeah, yes. It's one of my favorites.
That's such a good movie.
Yeah,
and the that was a crazy movie.
Yeah,
I should watch it again. We saw it in theaters in San Francisco when it came out.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
And that the transcript for that was taken from an actual journal, I believe, from the Massachusetts colony. Is that right? Do you remember? Do you know the story on that?
I don't know what his source material is, but you see flourishes of all of a lot of different, you know, various kind of stories. So what he used, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know what his source material was. Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Chud, have you ever seen The Witch?
The one that's stylized VV.
Yes, it's a Vitch.
Yes. Yeah. I saw that. That was a wild movie that kind of got in my head.
Yeah.
I think it was someone's journal from that time. I think that was what they
paid. Based on a real journal. Yeah.
Well, since the family was, you know, kicked out of the settlement, was it written by one of the family members?
Maybe. Well, it's a fictional account, so it's like it's an account that very well could have happened. Now, what had happened was they were very prejudiced against Quakers and against people who basically didn't believe in the same exact way that they did, and a lot of times they got kicked out just because of spiritual misunderstandings, right? And so they most likely would have been kicked out of the colony for something like, you know, something like that.
Theological difference or something like that.
A theological difference. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's quite possible because it happened, you know, it happened a lot. And so he based his story off of things that really could and have had happened at that period.
Yeah. I'm going to go check that one out maybe tonight. Chud, do you have any questions?
So far, this is fascinating stuff, though, for sure.
Yeah. I guess we can, do you guys want to move on from the old stuff and maybe get into some of MR's personal stories and what has happened in your life?
I'll say something on what we've been talking about. It's reminding me a little bit of, it was in Germany, probably about 100 years earlier. There was Peter Stump, or Stumpf with an F at the end, who was accused of being a werewolf. And I found that to be a pretty fascinating story. And when I looked at it again years after hearing it the first time, and I was finding that there was like a massive change in the religious doctrine in Germany at the time, where they were switching, I believe, to Lutheran from more Vatican based stuff, something to that effect. And it started looking to me like it was possible that Peter Stump wasn't possessed or turning into a werewolf, as people were saying, but instead that he was sticking with the old terms of the religious doctrine, and that might have been like why they executed him. They executed him very graphically in front of everyone, and that it was like maybe more like a warning to people who weren't staying up to pace with what was happening in Germany at the time. And just as you're talking about this stuff, it's kind of, you know, is it possible that there was just deviations from what other people were finding in their religious journeys at that time?
I don't know. I know that they, you know, they actually over in Germany and Europe at the time, they killed thousands and thousands of, you know, for witchcraft and things of that nature. Not everybody was, you know, there's so many that not all of them could have been witches, but they did have a heightened sense of superstition, I believe, and misguided or overzealous, I'd rather say, in the belief, you know, because it did stem from, you know, wanting to have, you know, didn't want to have this kind of evil, you know, in the land, you know, and so, but then, you get this overzealous, you know, believers in a superstitious court system, and all of a sudden you're setting witches on fire. But in Germany, they actually cut off their heads and burned them. So,
and in this case, they cut off his head. They sewed it to a dog because they were accusing him of being a, they cut off a dog's head and his head, sewed it onto it, pulled his body apart publicly, burned all of it. You know, like there's crazy wood carvings of what supposedly went down with this execution. I mean, it's like one of the most brutal things I've ever read about. And it was very public at the time. They wrote accounts of it. They passed it out to all different kinds of countries and wanted everyone to know this is what will happen if, as it was in this case, you become possessed by a werewolf.
Wow.
So I was really compelled by it when I heard about that when I was younger. But then when I looked at it again a few years ago, it was just the religious shift that was going on really made me think maybe there was something way different to the whole story than what I'd read before.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. It's worth I haven't heard it before, and it's worth taking a look at for sure.
Oh yeah, Peter Stump with an F.
Good to know. Okay, thanks.
Look up that guy.
Yeah. So MR, yes. Moving forward, we get into the second half of your book, and you start getting into some of your personal experiences with demons, hauntings, all that stuff. Can you get into that a little bit with us?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the book itself is actually an answer to a string of nighttime assaults that I was experiencing at the hands of, you know, demonic entities. And so I would be woken up in the middle of the night with steely hands around my throat, choking me half to death. The chest suppressings, like an, you know, like iron on my chest, pressing me into the bed, bitings, evil whisperings into my ears, you know, scratchings and things of that nature. And so The last thing that these entities want is to be exposed, because they function and operate in, you know, in darkness and in secrecy, and behind the scenes. And so the last thing that these dark forces want is to be exposed. And so I, the reason I wrote Demons Among Us was because, okay, you're going to attack me, I'm going to attack back. And so Demons Among Us is an answer to those nighttime assaults I was experiencing. And it wasn't just me, because at the time I was a prayer leader at the ministry that I go to, the church that I go to. And we had done a prayer nights on Thursday nights. And so when we were done, we're, you know, 30 of us, like we're in a circle. So I asked anybody, I'm like, is anybody else experiencing these nighttime attacks? And then one by one, you start to see these hands go up. Right. And by the time it was all done, it was like 13 hands. So it wasn't only happening to me. It was actually happening to other people, you know, very, very similar, similar assaults. And that's when I realized, like, okay, how many people are actually under assault, you know, unknowingly, you know, or under the influence of some kind of demonic power, and not even know it. And so, and that was, you know, that's, it was my mission, or is my, I felt compelled to write this book to kind of open the eyes of people to how these spiritual forces are working all around us.
Did you ever come to any sort of conclusion on why you were living in South Florida at the time, and why that it decided to target you and your group of fellow churchgoers at that time? Do you have any clue why it started happening?
Well, yeah, personally, because I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and they are an enemy to me, and I'm an enemy to them, and this is why they kind of go on the attack because they don't want any form of goodness, godliness, the advancements of the kingdom of God. They don't want anything. They don't want the gospel of Jesus Christ going forth. They want to, at all cost, stop people who operate and function in the power of Jesus Christ. And so, and that's why these things attack me and other people like me. So I have a target on my back because of what I believe. And so do people like me.
Got it. But nothing, there was no particular event that triggered it at that specific time, do you think?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. I know that they go on the attack when an individual decides to really step up their spiritual game or take to more aggressive prayer, or step up in ministry or become more influential in the things of God and in faith. And these satanic powers don't want that. They do everything they can to stop it, thwart it, frustrate it, and ultimately kill and destroy it. And so, to me, that's probably part of why it happened, because, you get a ministry who's moving in a more aggressive fashion in the things of the spirit, you're going to come under demonic assault.
Got it. Yeah. And then, it happened as you had life was coming at you. You were forced to move into your sister's old house. And, you describe it as looking, I forget if you said the Munsters or the Addams Family house.
Okay. Yeah. This is okay. So this is a different story. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So this was, so you're talking about was one of the most frightening experiences that I've ever encountered. Yeah. And the story is, that I had lost my position at a local newspaper in the marketing department. And so I couldn't afford my apartment downtown anymore. So I had to move out west, and I moved into a home that was left by a family member. And it was just sitting there for like 6 months or so. And so when I pulled up, I mean, it really looked like the Munsters could have lived there. and it was, the grass was brown and overgrown. It looked, there was just garbage everywhere. And even the fence was like all dilapidated and, you know, raw wood. And the fence door was hanging off of one hinge, just kind of creaking in the breeze.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, this is like all the hallmarks of a haunted house. And to, you know, and to add to that effect, the townhome itself has two big block bay windows on either side. And so it kind of looked out over the property with these, this vacant stare. And it looked a lot and very reminiscent to me of the Amityville Horror.
Oh yeah. And, I know that.
Yeah.
House. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and that's where I took up residence. And one night, I was upstairs. That's where the bedroom was. And I start to smell something pretty foul. You know, it smells like, you know, it smells like garbage or some kind of rot with like a chemical gassy kind of note. And so I start smelling around and I go, you know, go downstairs and it's, you know, it's not the garbage. It's not the garbage disposal. It's, you know, and then I look up at the air vent and I'm like, So I take a chair and I put it under the vent. I hike up and I, you know, and I go up and put my face to the air vent. And it's just this, this rot is just blowing and breathing onto my face. So it's coming out of the air vent and, you know, and this, it's a putrid odor. I mean, it's like sulfur too. It's, so it's like this rot with a sulfur kind of smell. So I get off the chair and I kind of have some suspicion that something's happening at this point. So I kill the power. I go to the utility box. I kill the power to the AC. Go back to the vent, hike up, back up on the fate, go back, hike up, back up onto the chair. And the thing is still blowing like onto my face without any power, without any mechanical assistance. This rot was just blowing, you know, through the vents unassisted at this point. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'm in for it tonight.
had you had any of the other attack experiences prior to that?
Yeah.
So yeah, you yeah, knew.
Yeah.
So you knew.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. That. That's okay. I was suspicious that I was in for it that
yeah,
night.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And so I go back up to, you know, go back up to bed, and I'm in bed, and it's about, it's 3:33 in the morning.
Of course.
And I hear something call my name. And it says out of the dark, and it says, Michael. Really slow, really serpentine, and really elongated and creepy. And I'm not going to turn. and it sounded like it was spoken. It was from the bowels of a cave. Like it was like, it was, as it sounded close, but yet far away at the same time.
Kind of echoey.
Yeah. Kind of like an echoey, like an echoey thing. Yeah. It was like, it was speaking from a cave in a sense. And so when I roll, I rolled over, and when I looked up, and there's this black form looming over my bed, cloaked in black. And it's staring down on me. I can see the semblance of its face staring down on me, but, you know, under the cowl of its hood. And it's got this broad mocking smile on his face, and he's looking at, you know, looking down on me with like this mocking, menacing smile. And that was the, you know, the first time I actually saw something like appear in that much of a physical form. And then I feel something on my chest. So I look down, and he's got these claws raking up my chest teasingly, like mock teasingly. And these nails, you know, were like weapon like nails calling up my chest. And I guess his idea was to choke me. And, But and I can feel this touch as real as any touch. And this is the what made it so frightening was that that was the first time I've encountered a spiritual form or spiritual entity physically, you know, touching me like as real as any other touch. And it was weird because there was as spiritual as it was physical, meaning that in its robe or its black, you know, gown, I could see that it was there were different parts of it, like towards the bottom, that you could see through, but everything else was a physical dimension. And it was the bottom of its robe was like moving, like it was underwater, like it was flowing. And I was like, wow, that's kind of like beautiful. Like I had this weird thought go through my head while I was like, wow, that's a something to the motion, you know? And the dress itself or the gown itself wasn't like shreds or anything like that, but it was weird because it was rectangular slats of black and gray fabric. And so the deeper you could see kind of like deep through it, and the deeper the layer, the blacker it got. And it was just kind of like moving with this watery form. And so that was, you know, that was my first encounter with something that kind of was, you know, a spirit entity touching me in that very physical form.
What do you think its motivation was?
To kill me?
Really?
Yeah. Because what happens is like, you know, not only does it just show up, but it shows up and you can literally feel the hot hatred emanating off of this being. I mean, it literally filled the room. And not only can you feel it like on your skin, but it was burning through me like a boiling tar. The hatred or the vehemency for me and for, you know, not just me, but for mankind. And so you can just feel it coming off in waves. And so when they show up, they come up, they kind of have this paralyzing power that you can't move and you can't speak for a second. It's like they take your ability to speak. And so, you know, so I'm just sitting there, you know, frozen for a minute. Yeah, you know, but it, obviously with those, you know, those claws, it was, its intent was to kill me because it was, that's why it was looking at me like with this mocking, you know, menacing sort of, you know, sideways look. But yeah, it was frightening to say the least.
How did you go ahead, disengage?
Well, when I was finally able to speak, I called on Jesus. Because Jesus gives the believers an unbelievable power. He says that I give you power to trample on snakes and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, meaning that he has given us a supernatural power over these supernatural fallen entities. These are, you know, fallen angels, right? And so he gives, he knows that we are defenseless against them in our own natural sense. So he gives and deposits this power inside of the believer. And so all you have to do is call on the name of Jesus. And I watched this thing sort of just melt into itself like droplets of mist. It was intense.
I'm being haunted now of stories of people who have night terrors who, yeah. You know, it really sounds a lot like that.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, I mean, it's to it. Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a night terror for sure.
But I mean, you know, the people who claim they've had night terrors, maybe it's...
Are you talking about night terrors or sleep paralysis, Deborah?
Aren't they kind of the same thing? I thought they were the same thing.
Night terrors are just horrible nightmares, I think, where you like scream.
Well, sleep paralysis, stuff. Where you feel like somebody is there with you and you're unable to...
Yeah, people with sleep paralysis always, a lot of the time, it's pretty weird because they talk about the same old lady, like a witch,
at the
foot of their bed and sitting on their chest.
Well, and basically the reason why I don't associate this as a you know, a night terror or a hag or, you know, sitting on my chest, because these things come with such palpable fear. And they, you literally feel the presence, the darkness, in the room. So for me, just to think that it's something happening while I'm sleeping, right, and not something demonic behind it, knowing what I know, it would go against everything that I know.
And you feel that you were conscious and awake while it was happening.
Oh yeah. The reason why I knew it was 3:33 was because it took the power out, and I had an alarm clock and it was blinking red against the night. 3:33, 3:33, 3:33. And so that's why I know it was 3:33, because when it appeared, it took the power out.
Man, there's a couple of aspects of that story that remind me a lot of something that a neighbor of mine experienced when I was a kid, where he was young too. He was older than me, but he'd stayed home from school for about 3 days and, you know, didn't come out or anything. And when I talked to him, I asked how he was doing, and he said he wasn't actually sick. He had been sick from fright. Wow. And he described waking up. It was still dark out. He didn't give a time or anything that I remember. And this is a long, long time ago. But he woke up and he was just paralyzed with fear. Yep. And like you said, he rolled over and there was this black image of like a person that was in his room.
Right.
And it reached out with this hand with like fingernails, like claws, I think is how he described it. And it's like the hand was massive and it was able to put a claw on each side of his temple.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely paralyzed with fear.
Yeah.
And there was so much pain going through his head, and it didn't go away until he could get his marbles and call the name Jesus Christ.
Yes.
At which point it disappeared.
Yeah.
And he was sick from the fear. Like he was like, his mom didn't send him to school because, you know, I don't know if she believed his story or not, but he couldn't eat and was pale and was, you know, as far as he was concerned when we were kids, that was exactly as he remembered it.
Yeah.
And there were just a couple of aspects of your story. I mean, that's wild.
Yeah. And it was weird because it was the entity itself was, it was tall and lanky and skinny, but had like crooked shoulders, you know. It was like it was weird. It was almost like Lurch or something, in a sense. It was like weird, like weirdly tall and, you know, and crooked shoulders and bent over. Like it was just, it was extremely strange. Yeah.
I'm envisioning, did you see the movie, The Babadook?
No, I've heard about it.
Envisioning that character. Did either of you guys see Adam? Or
was that crooked man?
Yeah, the kid, the little kid boy song. Reads the book.
Yeah.
That's just who I'm envisioning. Are there instances where angelic entities come and help, or?
Not in that instance.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if do they ever come and, we all know about guardian angels,
right,
but I'm wondering if there's ever been an instance where somebody has been rescued or.
I'm sure. I mean, you know, there is a lot of assistance in the, you know, in the supernatural realm, or the heavenly realm. So there's a lot of assistance for those and for believers and followers of Jesus, like, you know, sometimes are sent on assignment and stuff, but I talk about the angels in the book in one of the chapter, but it was only in regards to when I heard the heavenly choir of angels singing. And so that's the only experience that I have in my personal life where it was an angelic experience.
If you had allowed it to murder you, which we think what its motivation was, how do you think that would have physically presented? Like, are we seeing, are there people being found that have been murdered by demonic entities?
Sure.
Yeah. What would that look like? Sudden adult death syndrome or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be chalked up, you know, of course, you know, people being people would kind of try to slap some kind of name on it other than, you know, something demonic. Right. So, you know, they would always have some kind of name on it, and anything, but not to name it what it really is, you know, because a lot of times we try to slap natural names and natural titles on things, on supernatural, on things that are supernatural, you know, just because we don't understand it with our natural minds, you know. And so, you know, I believe there's a lot of, you know, psychosis, and I believe there's a lot of things that, you know, mental things. Now there are some mental things, but then there's other things that I think are actually demonic as well, that have a grip on people, but they just kind of like try to slap, you know, oh, schizophrenia or this or that on people. And they're trying to remedy people with a supernatural sickness with natural means, and they're never going to set these people free.
Yeah. Or so, unnatural drugs.
And unnatural drugs. And I talk about that in the book as well. It's a pharmacoi. Now, demons don't just appear as, like, you know, these, the entities I'm describing, but they also, they're known by their function and their form. And I discussed this in the book, by their role. And so in their role, there would be such a thing as fear, a spirit of fear, a spirit of anxiety, or a spirit of suicide, or a spirit of pharmacoi, where we get our word pharmacy from, or pharmaceuticals from. And that word in the ancient Greek means sorceries. So it's a, when we ingest these things, it's a form of sorcery. And there's, as these people are hearing voices who are on these medications. I talk about a couple of stories in the book of people who killed, who are on these medications.
Yeah. And I mean, every mass shooter that we see is on SSRIs.
Yeah. And the thing is so, but what you see, the common denominator is, well, I was hearing voices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when one kid was 12-year-old kid goes up and takes a gun and goes up into his grandparents' bedrooms and blows them both away. He's 12 years old. Right. And so in court, they're like, well, you know, what happened? And he's like, well, I was hearing voices. And, you know, and they say, well, what were they telling you to say? It was like, to kill. And then it came in rapid fire, like kill, 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 kill. Right. And so he said the only way to make these voices stop was to do what it was commanding me to do. And, you know, so, and that's just one story. There's a lot of stories like that. And, but I believe the common denominator between the ancient mysticism and the drugs used in ritual cults and cultic sects back in the ancient times is they used to use opium or the poppy to achieve this heightened state or spiritual state in order to hear, you know, hear information or like oracles and things of that nature. They would ingest poppy, whether it was smoked, whether it was inhaled or breathed. And they also had tablets as well. And so the common denominators, they used these to actually hear the voices of spirits, but they opened themselves up to demonic influence and spirits is what they heard. And so I believe what people are hearing when they're saying they're hearing these voices, these drugs, the common denominator here is that they also use the opioid or the poppy, whether it's derivative or if it's a real, or if it's the actual poppy in these drugs, it opens up somehow into this spiritual, it takes away this barrier of protection in the spirit realm, which gives them access into an individual's life, and they're just taking these drugs without even knowing it. and they're hearing these voices. And they just think that they're taking medications because the doctor told them to, but not knowing that the opioid is actually opening themselves up to hearing these things.
Yeah, it's reminds me a lot of what's going on currently with the promotion from the government at this point of psychedelics as like mm-hmm. healing agents. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, I've had over 100 psychedelic trips. And, mm-hmm. You know, that was really early on in my life when I shouldn't have been doing that.
Yeah.
And, as soon as the government starts promoting that in a way that's beneficial is when I start thinking like, this isn't good. And then, sure. As far as, other drugs go, I think methamphetamines are like the evilest of methamphetamines and alcohol, I think, are probably the two worst drugs that a person can take.
Yeah.
I think those are the ones that open people up to the most negative energy. I know Chud lives up in Washington. I live close to Portland, Oregon, and Deborah lives close to San Francisco, and there's mm-hmm. horrible, you know, homeless yeah. Problems here with, and it's not like, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and as you know, your local homeless guy is a guy with some old drunk hobo with like the big gin blossom nose who's mm-hmm. just trying to get another tall can of beer. And now there's just these immense populations of homeless people who are out of their minds,
yeah.
psychotic, yeah. dual diagnosis, constantly high on meth, and just it's scary stuff. And yeah. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me is that do you think that could be that kind of mental illness is demonic possession expressing itself?
I think there's a spiritual component to it.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to downtown Portland, you can't
yeah
not know that there's evil spirits around.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like I don't know per se if it's possession itself is the most extreme form. But basically what you have is a various forms of demonic influence, possession obviously being the most extreme form, but that they do get a hold of your life and they can oppress and they can influence and they can, ultimately, possess. So, it just depends on what, on each individual, where they are in this, you know, where they lie. You know, in regards to the amount of influence.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd imagine that their, how would I phrase it? Like their spiritual strength before using these drugs could affect those types of things too. You know, I'm an alcoholic myself. I don't drink anymore, but I often find myself looking back on things and I go, you know, I believe that alcohol was inhibiting my spiritual growth.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't move forward in a spiritual sense of things until after I got that monkey off my back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, other people, I think that they're opening themselves up for something like what we're talking about
yeah.
by continuing down that path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like the more, you use the stronger the influence grows, meaning like the deeper the hooks get put in, you know. Yeah. Bible talks about it as like a stronghold or a principality that has taken residence, you know, in a part of an individual's life. And alcoholism would be a stronghold.
For sure.
What do you think are some of the ways that people can safeguard themselves against stuff like this? Or is it just if you go down the path that you're on that you might be visited because they want you, because you know?
Yeah. Well, for me, it's the Bible talks about there's only one name under heaven in which men shall be saved, and that's the man Jesus Christ, right? So for me, there is outside of him, There is no protection. You can't, you know, you there's no charm you can use. There's no sage you can burn. There's no nothing. The only thing that has given mankind power over these powerful, powerful demonic forces is Jesus Christ. And so, you know, if someone or an individual is harassed or has in the grip of these demonic powers, it's only in his name that an individual can be set free.
Yeah. And I've heard stories over and over again of people who weren't necessarily even Christian or, you know, practicing at all, call out that the name of Jesus in situations like this and receive some sort of, you know, beneficial.
Yeah.
Just being protected from it. So
yeah
what as far as Deborah goes, she is from the tribe of the chosen ones, if you know what I mean. What should she do? Okay.
I was gonna say, you know, there's different religions, you know, there's Hinduism, there's whatever, Islam. I was raised in a Jewish family. Mm-hmm. I try to be a good person, I try to live right.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't follow, you know, I'm not saying me specifically, but somebody in my position necessarily doesn't follow Jesus.
Right.
So how?
There's no hope.
I mean, you have to be a Christian in order.
Well, here's what I will say. So, you know, a lot of times people open up these avenues and these doors knowingly and unknowingly, and tampering with things that our God, who had deemed or basically outlawed under the Old Testament, right, under the old law, right, which was talking about not seeing spiritists, not conjuring the dead, not fortune telling in astrology, or, you know, in all of these things that the God of the old covenant had said all these things are an abomination, right? And the reason why he outlawed them, that we were not to practice them, or the ancient Israelites were not to practice them, is because they opened themselves up to this kind of demonic manifestations, and it was not what God's design was for his people. Right. But God had sent his son, which was prophesied hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years before, the Messiah. God has sent his Messiah to be the protector of his people under the new covenant. You know, all along the Old Testament, he was saying, I'm going to send one like Moses. I'm going to send one like David. And this is the man, Christ Jesus, and it's under him where we have our protection. If we're out from under his protection, we remain susceptible to these kinds of attacks and open spiritually.
Not the answer you wanted.
No, it's not. I mean, because there's a, I don't know, what 32% of the world is Christian and the rest is something else, or somewhere like that. Don't quote me on that.
So, I believe in a man. I don't believe in a religion.
Okay. All right. That's a good answer.
And, I don't mean to steer this in a different direction at all, but it's like I had a good conversation with our friend Emmanuel Kingman, where he was kind of maybe suggesting to me that it isn't necessarily about the name Jesus Christ, but if you are following in the ways of Jesus Christ, maybe even unknowingly, that you do become a follower of Christ.
Yeah.
So if you're spiritually pure, if you're clean, and you're a good person by all standards by which Jesus would deem you to be, whether you're using his name or not, you are indeed praying to him, and you are indeed a part of his kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to agree with him on that.
I like that. I like that.
Thank you.
what do you think about tarot, Ouija boards, all that stuff? I know you just kind of gave a little synopsis of it, but
yeah, they're all branches of one tree, you know, and it's like, you know, it's one tree, many branches, right? So it's, and all of these are practices are occultic, and I believe that they open up an individual to a demonic influence. And if you were to expel a demon from someone who's been practicing these things, you know, the demon might say something to the effect like, well, I belong here. I was invited. Meaning that it wasn't like, hey, demon, come into me, but they needed an avenue in which to kind of enter somebody's life. And these are all doorways that allow entry into someone's life to be influenced by these spirits.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Even when I wasn't trying to pursue a Christian lifestyle, I didn't really feel good about messing around with that stuff. Yeah. Have you ever used a Ouija board,
Amar? I think, yeah, I have in the past. Yeah, I mean, before, you know, this was years ago. This is before I know what I know now.
Yeah,
how about, I wouldn't do it now.
How about you, Deborah?
Those things have always scared me.
Yeah. How they, about light as a feather, stiff as a board? You ever do that?
Oh, yeah, I did that
as a kid. I did that.
And,
yep.
And you know, tarot cards, done that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel I have friends that do it. You know, people that have been on the show, and I've, you know, bought my wife sessions with them and stuff, and I feel a little strange about it now. I wouldn't mess around with it now, but God, you ever mess around with a Ouija board?
Not really. I actually have one, but it's the board with nothing else. It doesn't have the what do they call it, the
planchette
or oracle thing or whatever,
that planchette thing.
Yeah.
Isn't that what it's called?
And it's I grabbed it from like a Value Village or something, because it says so boldly right on the front, brought to you by Parker Brothers. And
weird.
I thought that was kind of funny, and I picked it up, and it's just been, I couldn't even tell you where it is. It's packed away in a box somewhere that I haven't looked at it in 10 plus years.
Yeah, it's not one of the cool old, well, not cool, but unique old ones. It's like the cardboard, like fold up, like board game ones.
You flip it over and it's pressed particle board, and
yeah,
you know, and it's I don't know. It's I saw it as nothing real when I've never touched it and gotten a feeling from it. It seems like something that was mass manufactured by a board game company.
Yeah, I don't do that stuff. I'm scared of it too. So let's see, what else you guys got? Any more questions?
Just kind of interesting, this isn't a question, but that, you know, Parker Brothers or some big Mattel toy company is manufacturing Ouija boards and saying, here kids, go have fun with this.
Yeah.
Demons for kids.
Yeah.
There's more to that. You know, I really should reevaluate that. Because you know, it's more recent that I've started thinking that things like spells and demonic forces like these could work through a major company that's, you know, absolutely, pumping these things out. Just because it was mass manufactured, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have the intention put into it. Yeah, that that I don't want.
That's,
I mean, maybe if I go dig that thing up and get it out of my house, I'll find something is better.
Yeah.
You know, that something's been relieved. Maybe the smoke will blow away from my atmosphere that I've been sitting in for over a month.
Yeah. Billy Ray Valentine on the Infinite Fringe, he had like the curator of the nation's preeminent Ouija board museum on the show once. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. He gave like a really good history of where they came from and what they're doing. And then in this book, Deborah and I are reading, Occult Feminism, they talk about kind of the transformation from old Christianity in the late 1800s into like the spirituality movement and the new age. Mm-hmm. And they were all into like channeling and all that stuff. And man, it's all bad news, man. I watched that movie, Hereditary. Like the only modern horror movie that's like scared me in the past 20 years, you know.
Yeah.
And, they get into, I want to watch that. Maybe I'll watch The Witch and Hereditary.
Yeah.
For Halloween. That's what I'll do.
Yeah.
But, you ever see that one, Chud?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a
Hereditary's
freaky.
Yeah.
Freaky movie.
Yeah.
This Agreed. Is maybe not as heavy as that, but what's it called? American Gothic, but it had the actor Donald Sutherland and Chrissy Spacek as a married couple, John Bell and the Bell Witch.
Well, the Bell Witch, the book I read, and it's great.
That was a scary thing.
The Bell Witch, huh? Which one was that? What's the story behind that?
In like late 1700s, early 1800s, maybe, this guy appropriated some property that belonged to this old hag woman, right? And they went to court because correct me if I'm wrong about this. This is according to the movie. She didn't want to give up her land. It was her land. And they went to court and the court ruled for her. But anyway, so she wanted revenge and is the way the story goes, and started attacking one of his daughters and attacking him himself. And
When it's got Donald Sutherland in it, when's it from? The 80s?
No, maybe the 90s.
I'll check it out. I'll look into it. But
I'll find the name for you.
Yeah. MR, this was a good interview. Do you have any final thoughts, anything you want to add before we get out of here and let you go?
No, I guess tell people where they can find the book.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, you can find Demons Among Us, Shocking Real Life Stories from the Paranormal, on Amazon. It's an Amazon number one bestseller, and it's available right now in Kindle version for $1.99, and it's available in print as well. I'm working on the audio version. The audiobook version hopefully will come out soon. I don't have an exact date, but it's coming. And what else? Oh, I was I'm shopping a script right now, a full length feature film about a witch trial, and currently seeking for people to jump on board on that. So, if anyone wants to jump on board, give me a shout. And it's a pretty scary piece of horror for sure.
That sounds incredible. Great.
If anybody wants to do that, is there a best way for them to contact you?
Oh yeah. You can reach out to me on Instagram at m.r.gorga or on Facebook at mrgorga.
That sounds awesome. I'll link to all that stuff in the show notes. And cool. Deborah, Chud, any last thoughts?
This was good stuff.
Yeah, this is absolutely fascinating. This is, I love every minute of it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Right on. Thanks, Amar. I'm going to finish your book up in the next couple of days. And I really appreciate you coming on. And let us know what's going on with your manuscript, if it gets picked up and all that stuff. Hopefully, hopefully we can get you some support. So thank you.
That'd be great. Thank
we really
you so
appreciate
much.
It. And this is a fun one. But awesome. Right on. Have a good night, Great. Guys. Love you all.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people or those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order are idiots. playing God all day, deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.